Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Democracy will succeed in Iraq, President Bush told a London audience today. But in Iraq itself, where a war rages on, that outcome is hardly clear or guaranteed. The number of U.S. dead has spiked. Iraqi and international allies are dying. Insurgents are growing bolder. And the U.S. is planning a pullback tonight on Point Reality Check. Who's winning the war in Iraq? But first, we go to London, where President Bush today spent the first full day of his state visit. Over the course of the day, the president was met with both celebration and protest. The president gave a major Iraq policy speech this morning. This evening, he dined in splendor at Buckingham Palace. Justin Webb is Washington correspondent for the BBC and is traveling with the president. I asked him to describe the tenor of the visit so far.
It's a success. That's what the White House is saying, and that's what the Brits are saying. And I suppose to a large extent, that's probably the case. Nothing went wrong. The ceremonial was all got through, and the various 41-gun salutes and marches past and guards of honor, etc., all looked very glittering under not desperately good weather, I have to say, rather leaden skies. But still, it all passed off, and we're told President Bush enjoyed it. And then he made his big speech, which he made rather well. He made some quite good jokes, and nobody heckled, and that was ticked off also as a success. And then later in the day, had a number of other meetings also, we're told by the White House, they were all private, that those went well. As well, and indeed the president appeared to be becoming more effusive as the day went on. We're told that when he met relatives of British people who were killed in the World Trade Center, the president said that the friendship between Britain and the United States was one of the greatest friendships in the history of mankind. So, for all those reasons, people are pleased. I have to say, though, just watching it, I was at Buckingham Palace when the official welcome was being organized. It just has a slightly sterile air to it, because the one thing missing from all of this is any sign of the British public. They didn't show up, although they could have showed up. There was no security issue. They were allowed to go, but nobody really did show up for the ceremonial welcome. And, of course, for various reasons, there are no scheduled appointments between President Bush and the great mass of the British public. So, yes, it's a success, but limited, perhaps.
President Bush talked about the United States' determination not to retreat from what he called a band of thugs in Iraq. But he also joked about his mixed reception in the United Kingdom, talking about the illusionist David Blaine. He said something like, he said, "It was pointed out to me that the last noted American to visit London stayed in a glass box dangling over the Thames. A few might have been happy to provide similar arrangements for me," and got a laugh, we're told.
Yeah, that was a good line, because, you know, the Brits like kind of self-deprecating humor. We think that we're rather good at it, and we sort of appreciate it when other people have a go. And President of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, does not often have cause to be self-deprecating, and he was, and it did go down very well. And frankly, the demonstrations today were such that you could quite easily laugh them off. They were quite small in number, and mainly young people who were enjoying the opportunity to shout and blow whistles, etc. It wasn't in any sense a kind of mass movement of the great British public of Middle England, as they say. So I think it was perfectly okay for the president to get away with simply laughing them off.
So a success in the White House eyes. What about Tony Blair? Does this patch it all up? Is he out of the woods politically?
No, it doesn't really do him any good, to be honest. He's managed to scrape through only a few hours ago a vote in the Commons. Nothing to do with President Bush. It's something to do with health service reforms here. But it's a vote which he should have won by many, many votes. And, you know, we have very strict party discipline in Britain. It's very unusual for a member of one party not to vote for it, but he only scraped through by a handful of votes, and he is wounded. There's no doubt about that, and there are some who are suggesting that fatally so. But, I mean, in the longer term, the relationship with George Bush is unquestionably, I think it's fair to say, a political hindrance to Tony Blair, simply because large numbers of the British people, indeed a majority of the British people, although they have great affection for America, do not appear to have great affection for George Bush.
And stepping back for a moment, the first full-scale state visit by an American president since 1918, Woodrow Wilson.
Well,
is Tony Blair still happy that he's putting on the dog for this president?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting issue, actually. Buckingham Palace says it's the first state visit ever by an American president. They appear to have downgraded Woodrow Wilson's visit to just an ordinary visit. The State Department, even at one stage, suggested that Ronald Reagan's visit in 1982 was a full state visit, and both the White House and the Palace say, no, that's not the case. So there is a sort of ongoing disagreement about whether or not this is unprecedented, but whether or not it is, plainly, it is a very big deal. And it has been done by the government, put through by the government. So they went out on a limb for the president. And frankly, I don't think in terms of public opinion here that they're going to get very much back from it.
And George Bush skating through with some success today. Justin Webb, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Justin Webb is Washington correspondent for the BBC and is traveling with the president. He spoke with us from London. Attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq have sharply escalated in the last month, increasing in both sophistication and scale of death. Little is on schedule. Troubles abound. Even as President Bush reaffirms U.S. commitment to bringing democracy to Iraq, the White House is overhauling its strategy, dramatically speeding transfer of sovereignty to Iraqis and the drawdown of U.S. troop levels next spring. As the U.S. plans to pull back, Saddam loyalists appear to be surging forward. Tonight, we're posing the question, who is actually winning the war in Iraq? The U.S. or the heirs of Saddam? Saddam himself. What do your eyes and ears tell you? Will the U.S. tough it out for democracy or leave with something less? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Earlier today, I spoke with Michael Ware, correspondent for Time magazine in Baghdad. I asked him for his on-the-ground take on who's winning the war.
Right now, unfortunately, I would have to say that it's certainly not the coalition who's winning. Really, this battle is not being won on the battlefield. It is being won in the living rooms here in Baghdad and, dare I say it, in the West. This is now a political fight. And I would have to say that right now it is the Iraqi-based homegrown resistance that politically is winning. That is certainly how the resistance fighters themselves see it. They regard the fact that the American administrator here, Bremer, and the White House has now proposed this accelerated timeline for a handover of power and sovereignty to a rapidly formed Iraqi government as a victory for them.
Michael Ware, what you're describing as a living room war is being driven by many single incidents of violence. Walk us through the litany of pinpricks or greater that the coalition forces and others have faced from resistance in Iraq in the last month and more.
Well, what we're talking about is a rate of, at the bare minimum, daily attacks. These are sniping little affairs. It is a bomb by the roadside. It is mortars lobbed inside a presidential palace that is housing U.S. commanders. It is a sniper from a house picking off U.S. soldiers. It's a drip feed. What we're looking at is an increase in the rate of these attacks. Several months ago, the military spokespeople here were talking about an average of 12 attacks a day. Well, now that rate has risen. The batting average has gone way up. We're now looking at sometimes as much as 30 attacks on U.S. soldiers a day. And that's notwithstanding the greater triumphs, as the resistance would call it, downing a U.S. helicopter that killed 16 soldiers, blowing up a police station. The bigger events just punctuate the daily beat of slow attacks. And it's forced the American soldier, your average GI, into a position where, quite frankly, he's living on his wits' end. And the Iraqis say, we have the stamina to keep this up. Do you, the Western soldier, have the stamina to stay here and put up with it? We don't think so.
Michael Ware, you know that President Bush, today again in London, and top generals in Iraq have said we cannot be defeated militarily. President Bush has said we have the will and the resolve. We cannot leave. We cannot lose here. So their reply is very clear as well. We won't go.
Well, I think that we're going to see that determination put to the test in the months to come, particularly with what many people here on the ground believe is actually driving the U.S. mission here right now, which is the presidential election cycle. If things don't rapidly improve over the next 6 months leading up to the elections at the end of next year, then that's going to put the current administration in an extraordinarily difficult position. President Bush is going to find a tough electoral battle. And I have to tell you that the resistance here is aware of that. And they plan to exploit that. And they believe that they have President Bush in a vulnerable position right now.
President Bush says that the U.S. won't allow failure in Iraq, that it won't be driven out in failure. But he's very gung-ho now on Iraqification, turning power, sovereignty, and military responsibility over to Iraqis. What's the picture of Iraqi forces there? How might they face this threat differently? Might they be more successful or less?
There's two arguments here of equal weight. One is that no one knows Iraq like the Iraqis, that foreigners coming in here can't hope to even begin to understand this place. And look, quite frankly, there's Iraqi methods of going about business. Iraqi police operate in a way that those of us in the West would shudder to contemplate. So to some degree, there's a belief that only the Iraqis can solve the problems here. Yet the flip side to that is looking at the resources that are available to the Iraqi security services, which, though they're being boosted by the U.S. administration, still remain minimal and requiring much more.
But if Iraqis are back in charge and their impulse is to compromise, might we not see Ba'athists back in power, Saddam's party back in power?
Well, I don't think we'll see the party as such back in power, but I think it is a matter of inevitability that we'll see some of the old characters back in positions of power. And there is a strong argument among the Iraqi people that these people, though they were Ba'athists, simply have to be allowed to return in some capacity. Otherwise, what do we do with them? Plus, these are the people who hold the corporate knowledge and the experience of running this country. This is a division that, speaking to Western diplomats, we're seeing emerge between, say, the coalition partners. I mean, there's a belief that Administrator Bremer and others would like to see, as it was coined to me by a diplomat recently, a new Texas here in Iraq, a shining model of democracy that functions in a way that is remarkably similar to what we are familiar with. However, they're saying other coalitions of partners are saying this is a false expectation. Don't build it so high. That is not going to happen. The best that we can hope for is some form of a democracy that is vaguely familiar to us and at the very best is not hostile to the West.
At this point, the Bush administration might welcome that if it brought stability there. Does that look like where we are headed? And can the Bush administration call that victory?
Well, whether it's a victory, that's a very difficult question. It comes down to a matter of what are the ultimate objectives that America is hoping to achieve here. Certainly, I believe what it was that the American administration was hoping to achieve at the outset is certainly not going to emerge. I believe that they would have had to have adjusted their ultimate outcomes, and they're going to have to come to be happy with that. Whether that's a victory, I think that's something that the American people are going to have to decide, but it's not going to be the original plan.
Michael Ware, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Michael Ware is Time Magazine correspondent. He spoke with us from Baghdad. We're asking a question tonight. Who is winning the war in Iraq? Is the U.S. winning? Is Saddam or Saddam's loyalists winning? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. What do your eyes and your ears tell you? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking a question tonight, and it's this. Who is winning the war in Iraq? You can join our conversation. With choppers coming down, mortar fire hitting U.S. headquarters, allies being assassinated, U.S. deaths mounting, who do you think is winning in Iraq? And will the United States tough it out with your support? Can Washington hang tough and pull out at the same time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We're joined tonight from Charleston, South Carolina, by Lawrence Korb. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1985. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. And joining us from Cornwall on Hudson in New York tonight, military historian Fred Kagan. He's co-author of While America Sleeps, Self-Delusion, Military Weakness, and the Threat to Peace. Good evening and welcome, Fred Kagan.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Lawrence Korb, to you first. You've just returned from Iraq in the last week or so. We know it's perhaps too simple a question, and yet we can't help asking it because the big pronouncements out of Washington and today London are so kind of sweeping. On the ground in Iraq, who's winning?
Well, if you have to understand, the other side doesn't have to win. They have to just not lose. And if you look at it that way, I say right now that they're ahead because they have basically caught us unprepared for what has happen and cause the administration to shift the directions a third time. And the question becomes, have they picked the right strategy now, and will they be willing to see it through?
So the evidence is that they're not losing, which is a kind of victory. And what is the evidence of that?
Well, basically what's happened is they've got the administration to accept, do something they didn't want to, which was to turn sovereignty over to the Iraqis very, very, very quickly. They've got the U.S. military to go much more on the offensive, which could risk alienating some of the population if some of these very heavy strikes go astray. They're taking a chance that the new government that they set up will be effective, will get the allegiance of the people, and will ask us to stay, because if we turn power over to this government at the end of June, they're sovereign now, and we would not be occupiers. We'd be seen as guests. And the question becomes, will they, you know, ask us to do that? And then, you know, the final thing is we're cutting, as the danger increases, we're cutting the number of troops and relying on a very, very hastily trained Iraqi military and police force to work with us.
Fred Kagan, there's a lot to talk about tonight, but to this simple question first, who's on a winning track in Iraq in your view? General Abizaid has said the United States cannot be defeated militarily in Iraq. Does that mean that U.S. victory is guaranteed? Who's winning?
I would say that it's on a knife edge right now. I think that there are a lot of positive developments that have been going unreported and underreported. The objective quality of life situation in Iraq is improving mm-hmm. for a lot of Iraqis. There are a lot of programs underway to accelerate that improvement, and I think that that is something that will begin to generate momentum in the right direction, and is probably already generating momentum in the right direction. I do think that the military situation is problematic. General Abizaid is right, but he knows better than anyone else that this is not going to be won militarily. And unfortunately, I think that the strategy, I agree with everything that Larry Korb said, that the strategy the administration is now proposing to pursue is extremely risky, and I'm afraid that it may push us over the knife's edge in the wrong direction, but I would not say right now that we are actually losing.
Not losing, but you're saying the strategy that's just been announced in Washington may push the U.S. off the knife's edge in the wrong direction here.
Yes, I think that they are doing the wrong thing, and I think it's important to keep in mind that what they're doing is driven only partially by what's going on in Iraq. It's also being driven by a very unfortunate decision taken early on not to face the actual military requirements of this and other sorts of missions, and to keep our military forces so small that we are not capable, without excessive pain, of maintaining the kind of commitment in Iraq militarily that we need in order to succeed. That actually is what drove the initial decision to come up with this rotational plan that has us down 30,000 troops in Iraq in April.
Lawrence Korb, so there's a knife's edge description. You say if you're not winning, you're losing in a way. Because if they're not losing, they are winning. You've just come back. Help us with this drumbeat of things we've heard out of Iraq in recent weeks. I mean, it's begun to mount up to the point where there's some cognitive dissonance when the president stands so confidently. We've all seen the drumbeat of deaths, those spikes when the choppers have gone down, first one, then two, allies being assassinated, the big picture on the front of the New York Times today of all the funeral, all the coffins in Italy, NGOs pulling out, violence outside the Sunni triangle, the sophistication of attacks stepping up, these attacks in central Baghdad on U.S. headquarters, and on, power still not on, U.S. troops reported hunkering down, afraid to do patrols now, Saddam not captured, and on TV. I mean, are these, can we whip ourselves into a frenzy of too much concern about these things, or are these indicators of a U.S. position in real trouble?
Well, the problem is that the administration kept trying to put this gloss on everything. As has just been pointed out, they underestimated the number of troops that would be needed to stabilize the country. I mean, when General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, says several hundred thousand, they, dismissed him out of hand and, made some very derisive comments about him. So they didn't have enough troops in there. And then they began to just emphasize the positive, and when people emphasized some of the negative, they kept blaming it on the media. And then the president made the absurd statement here a couple of weeks ago that with the increase in violence, that showed we were succeeding because the other side was becoming desperate. And so I think that's part of the problem, is that the administration has not faced up to the difficulties of winning the peace there. If they in fact do, when I was over there, all we got was the positives. And if you had dinner, as I did, or lunch with the soldiers and talked to them, then you got the negatives. But if you were talking to, Jerry Bremer or David Kay or some of the commanders of the units, they just emphasized the positive. I mean, the beginning of success there has got to be to recognize the difficulties. And, Rumsfeld's memo that was leaked, it's going to be a long, hard slog. Well, that's not what we were led to believe.
Tell us what you heard directly from American soldiers. We're inclined to trust them.
Yeah, I mean, the American soldiers would tell you how tough it was and that they were hunkering down, that they were afraid to, afraid to go out. They didn't know who they could trust. And a lot of them even felt that they weren't really trained for this type of operation. The 4th Infantry Division, which is up in the Tikrit area, Saddam's hometown, is the most sophisticated division we have in the Army, and yet they're out there chasing bank robbers sometimes.
I'm struck, Fred Kagan, your brother Robert at the Weekly Standard wrote very recently that failing in Iraq would be a strategic calamity worse than America's retreat from Vietnam 30 years ago. Senator John McCain has been very critical of the Bush administration, said that the only acceptable exit strategy is victory. And yet I don't hear either of you, Lawrence Korb in a liberal think tank, you from a famous neoconservative family, I don't hear either of you expressing confidence in that victory tonight.
Well, I think it's hard to be confident in it. It's something that is hard, and it's been hard all along. And I agree that the Bush administration has been Pollyanna-ish in the way that they have presented this all along, and I've been opposed to that all along. But I think that that's really not the issue.
Okay.
The issue really is, you have to put yourself in the position of the Bush administration. They're now under an enormous amount of fire. They're criticized and called liars for everything that they've said about Iraq from the beginning to the end, some of which criticism is quite justified. But it's very unlikely in that circumstance that anyone is going to go to Iraq now and be taken around by senior officials and told, you see all the problems that we have.
Mm-hmm.
The hostile partisan climate that has developed in this regard will make it very difficult for anybody to come up with objective evaluations of this, which is a problem.
But if without those objective evaluations, without that candor, yeah. Are we sliding into kind of internal contradictions here? John McCain says you don't draw down your troop levels when the troops who are there are suffering casualties like this. That means it's only going to get worse. But that is exactly what's being planned. So is the next step, this Iraqification, a genuine step toward a more successful involvement in Iraq, or is it a kind of political palliative for the American public, which may actually leave us with things worse off?
We need to separate two issues here. Iraqification is a good idea. We're going to have to turn it over to the Iraqis, and we would like to do that as soon as possible.
Okay.
But that is separate from pulling our troops out and turning all of these responsibilities over to the Iraqis prematurely.
But that's what's planned now, a troop pull-down.
That is what is planned now, and I think that it's a mistake. And that's why I have a hard time being optimistic. I'm optimistic about the situation in Iraq. I think that if we would do the right thing now, we can still win this. But I'm afraid that the administration is on the verge of doing the wrong thing. And that's why you hear from me pessimism of a sort that I think the basis is maybe a little bit different from what Lawrence Korb has been saying.
Larry Korb, let's just get you on that. Fred Kagan is saying step up and forgive me, Fred, for summarizing so broadly, but step up and do everything you need to make this happen. Fred Kagan, would you say even keep the troop levels up or increase them?
I would. I think that this is the single most important foreign policy problem that we face right now. Success could bring us untold benefits in the Middle East. Failure can bring us untold catastrophe.
Larry Korb, Fred, would you step up those troop levels, Larry Korb?
Well, if you can't get international support, if you're not willing to do what's necessary to get it, yes, I would. I think General Shinseki was right, and I think that the president should have told the American people that when we went into this war that was going to require, several hundred thousand troops for a long period of time. Whether he still would have had the same level of support or not, I think is a different question. But I think we're there now, and we can fail. There's no way we can fail. We have to do what's necessary not to fail.
But Fred Kagan says we're not doing what's necessary
avoid
failure.
We agree, even though we might come at this from different points. And Fred and I agree on this. In fact, I was showing some of my colleagues at work the other day, I said, well, look at the Weekly Standard here. You know, what they're saying, they're not very supportive of the president anymore at all, because it seems to me that this policy that was, brought about last week when Ambassador Jerry Bremer came home and they changed it was completely different than what Bremer had told us was the policy the week before.
Well, he said just a few weeks before that shortcutting the process would be dangerous for the U.S. to get out early. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Mike is calling from Boston. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for hearing me.
Good to have you.
As far as your question is who's winning the war, them or us, I feel it's a war we could never win. You could put all the troops we have in that country, and you could never win that war.
That's pretty pessimistic. Why, Mike?
Why? Because whatever, it will always be a lightning rod for hostile al-Qaeda forces or hostile countries, which are all around that country.
But we're being told right now that it's primarily Iraqis themselves, maybe leftover supporters of Saddam, who are the backbone of the insurgency.
Well, we're told a lot of things, and we were told that there was weapons of mass destruction, so on and so on and so on. The fact is that will always be a beacon of democracy that will always be try to be stamped out by the forces in the country and around the country.
So what would you do? Just walk away?
Well, there's nothing we can do. We need to allow them to have their government.
Yeah.
Put in a government and then leave. Now, that government will not survive, because any government that was put in place by this country will never survive as well. They will always look to be related to us, and they won't survive.
But better to do that than to hang in there and get chewed to death. Mike, thanks for your call. Fred Kagan, how about it? This is interestingly related to what we heard from Michael Ware of Time Magazine at the top of the hour. He's kind of projecting that what will actually happen here is well short of a democracy emerging, some significant elements of the old Saddam regime, the U.S. out, something way short of democracy, and Washington just having to live with it. Is that an acceptable outcome? Is that victory?
Well, the way he described it, no, I would say that that's not victory. On the other hand, I don't think it's necessary to establish a pure Jeffersonian democracy in Iraq either.
Mm-hmm.
We need to establish a stable representative form of government in Iraq that is suitable to the Iraqi people, and I'm not sure what exactly that looks like. I agree with the caller that any democratic Iraqi regime is going to be a lightning rod for subsequent attacks. It's also going to be a beacon of hope to Arabs and Muslims who would like to believe that they can have representative political institutions, and I think that it is well worth the price that we would have to pay to defend it against those attacks in order to have that beacon and start spreading a countercurrent of democratization in a region which has known only tyranny and violence.
But that's a different thing than sitting there and losing, not establishing that beacon. Habu's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Habu. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Good evening to you,
good
and
evening.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Beacon, as a sidebar, a beacon of hope, you think the people there who see America as being one-sided in the Israel-Palestinian conflict and then installing a government, and that's going to be a beacon of hope?
We kind of imagine that people are capable of holding even clashing dissonant thoughts in their mind at one time, Habu. I mean, they didn't apparently like Saddam all that much. A better economy, a better political system sounds attractive.
And these people detest Saddam as much as they detest our presence there, but they're not going to just take a roll over and have an installed government which does somewhat our bidding, with the companies going in there, taking over the state institutions. That's not ours to take. But anyway, if I may just get to my main point.
Yes, please.
This is a guerrilla war, and let's call it what it is. And they have three very quick points. They have isolated us by making Japan rethink its deployment, Korea scale back, mm-hmm. Italy's even rethinking. Secondly, they've successfully delayed the reconstruction and economic recovery of Iraq, detonating pipelines, etc. And thirdly, they have a sympathetic, as we have a hair trigger response. People are getting shot. And our poor soldiers, they don't know what to do. I mean, they don't know where the fire is coming from. And this is alienating the public. And the public doesn't even have to support these people as much as not betray them. And if I may end with an anecdote that was from the Vietnam era, before the fall of Saigon, an American officer and a North Vietnamese colonel had this exchange. "You know, you never defeated us on the battlefield," the American said. The North Vietnamese colonel pondered this remark a moment and said, "That may be so, but it is also irrelevant."
Because the U.S. was out and they took over, and that was that. Habu, thanks very much for your call. Larry Korb, how about it? Is this winnable?
Well, it's winnable, providing you're prepared to pay the price to win it. And, one of the soldiers, and I happen to agree with him, I said this even before the war started, you're talking about the United States being there for a decade. If we're willing to do that, to bear the casualties, have an orderly transition to a government that has the support of the people, and have an Iraqi army and police force that's adequately trained and embraces democratic values, yes, you can. But I don't think you can do it as quickly as we would like. I mean, I thought Michael Ware made a terrific point when he said that the insurgents over there are aware of the electoral cycle. And I just hope that that's not what got the president to pick this June 30th deadline for putting in this new provisional government and for cutting down the number of troops.
Right. Everybody's aware of that electoral cycle, but does it lead us toward a winning strategy? Lawrence Korb, Fred Kagan, stand by. We're asking a question tonight. Who's winning the war in Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking a simple question tonight about a very complex situation. Who is winning the war in Iraq? You can join the conversation. What do your eyes and ears tell you? President Bush says democracy will succeed in Iraq. Do you believe him? Has the recent surge in the Iraq death toll and sophistication of attacks shaken your confidence or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Charleston, South Carolina, by Lawrence Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And from Cornwall-on-Hudson, New York, military historian Fred Kagan, co-author of While America Sleeps. Right now, Brian is calling from Menesha, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
I think the question itself frames the debate in a way that may not be valid anymore. We've already won the war. The question we should be asking now is, what do the Iraqi people want, the majority, and how do we get there, and are we doing that? That's what really interests me the most.
Brian, I'm all for that, but let me just ask you. I mean, the American generals in Iraq are saying we are still at war, and they're using that word very specifically and very pointedly. So can we say we've already won the war?
And what we're doing now isn't a war in the traditional sense of a war. It's a policing action at this point. And what we really need to do is help the Iraqis get to where they want to be so that they can take over. We need to help them with infrastructure and basic security. But in terms of a war, we've already gone in and occupied the country. We've won the war.
Brian, thanks for your call. Larry Korb, how about it? First, have we already won this war, and has the United States already won it? And secondly, to Brian's question looking forward, what needs to be done next? But take up the first part of that.
Well, if you say your objective was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, you can say that you've accomplished that objective. But you have not made Iraq a stable democracy, not any kind of stable government. And because of that, you really haven't accomplished your objective. I mean, the president is arguing we're fighting the war, global war on terror in Iraq, so we won't have to fight it, you know, in Boston or Brooklyn. I don't happen to buy that, but that's the way that this administration is looking at that. And certainly in that sense, you haven't won it. In fact, I would argue that the invasion of Iraq and this subsequent occupation has actually made us less safe because it's energized al-Qaeda.
Fred Kagan, same question. The caller, Brian, says, hey, we've already won this.
Well, I think we certainly did not. The objective was not simply to remove Saddam. The objective was always to establish a stable democratic regime in Iraq, and we haven't succeeded at that yet. And the military operations that we're going through now are part of that effort. But I would like to take up something that Larry just said, which is that this is not part of the war on terror. I don't think that's true. I think that this is a critical part of the war on terror, because I think that it's not, you don't fight a war on terror, and I know Larry has said this in his articles. You fight a war against an enemy, and the enemy may use terror as a weapon. Mm-hmm. The war is really against radical Islamism, and that's a political ideology that has a particular vision of the Middle East that these people are trying to use unconventional methods to accomplish. We can't tolerate that ideology. It's hostile to everything we believe in.
That ideology was not particularly potent in Iraq before the war.
No, it wasn't, but the... what we are trying to do is set up a countercurrent in Iraq, and there has been no such countercurrent. This is becoming an ideological conflict, and just as in the Cold War, it was necessary to support democratic ideals in order to counter an anti-democratic ideology. So we have an opportunity now in Iraq to fight this war on that ideological basis by helping to establish democracy and creating an alternate model for Arabs and for Muslims in general.
I can see you two may part ways on that, but let me ask you this, Fred Kagan. What about the basic assumption here that at least we've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein? Is that fair to say? He's not dead. He's not in custody. We read that his top deputies may be orchestrating this insurgency. Is it fair to say that Saddam Hussein has really been flushed out of Iraq?
Well, no, obviously it's not that he's been flushed out of Iraq, but it is fair to say that we've got rid of him in the sense that he is no longer in control of the country. And frankly, I think there's no prospect that he will return to control of that country.
But if his cohort is still calling the shots, pulling the strings, manipulating the situation in Iraq, and hoping for some kind of return to power, does that qualify as a cleansing of Saddam or Saddamism?
Well, it wouldn't, but I think you're overstating the degree to which they're in control of the country. I think Larry put it very well at the beginning of this program. Mm-hmm. The objective of insurgents is not to win, but to not lose, to avoid losing. That doesn't put you in control of the situation.
And well, it doesn't put you in control right now, but doesn't it appear as though the end game is to create enough chaos that they have a chance to reclaim some of their power?
It is. That's certainly their objective. I do not think they will succeed. Even, frankly, if they flush us out of the country, I think that they will not succeed in reclaiming power in that country.
Shah's calling from Boston. Hi, Shah. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to comment that I think that we are actually winning the war, that we definitely have certain setbacks, but it will be a long and painful process. This is not something which we could just rush out of. I think it's something which the United States is going to have to see through. And if we don't, there'll be serious repercussions. And if we do, I think that the repercussions on the positive side will be just as great, because people all over the Middle East and South Asia have a real thirst a real desire and aspirations to have democracy.
So you're saying just by jumping in there, there's a kind of victory, just by getting engaged with that process?
Well, not only that, but now that we are engaged, I don't think that we can cleanly disengage. We can't just walk away. It would be too costly to us to walk away. We have to win, and frankly, we are winning.
And the evidence of that?
Well, the evidence of that, as one of your callers said, the military side, as far as an occupation, is a fait accompli. I mean, we're there.
Okay. We're there, but we're, you know, God love the soldiers, and we hope that it all succeeds, but they look like they're hunkered down. They're getting shot. It doesn't look good, Shah, does it?
Well, no. I mean, it doesn't look good. But if you look in terms of a war, the number of casualties, while, you know, I regret every loss of life, it's not that significant.
Still within your margin of acceptability. Shah, thanks for your call. Brad's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Well, the first thing I want to do is tell you, I find the program unbelievably good. This is the first time I ever heard two separate commentators that were not, you know, so specializing in spin. Their objectivity is remarkable, and I just want to tell you.
We're glad for that, too, Brad, and glad to have you on. What's on your mind?
I just want to say that the one thing about the beam of hope, you know, I just don't think that we had any business there. I think we've committed financially unbelievably to something that has more to do with politics than anything else. The need around the nations, let's go help, you know, let's get democracy in Saudi Arabia. I mean, all I'm saying is, and let's not pretend that we're there because we really care about those people so much when there's so much other stuff that there's even a bigger, stronger need on. I know that guy's a bad guy. Everybody agrees that he was a bad guy. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the allocation of, you know, responsible allocation of what resources we have.
And you don't want to be strung along by a beam of hope. On the other hand, everybody's saying we've got to move it. Brad, thanks so much for your call. Lawrence Cole, we've just got a minute and a half left. Your 30-second prescription for what it's going to take to reach something like a victory for Washington and for the Iraqi people.
I mean, 10 years of occupation and expenditure, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of money.
That's a long time. Are you confident Washington will go the course?
I'm not confident that they will, and I just hope that we don't, you know, have electoral politics get in the way.
And Fred Kagan, your prescription?
I think that we need, probably will take less than 10 years. I would say 5 years is more realistic. And I think that we need more troops and we need a substantial commitment of resources over that period.
So if you could speak to President Bush tonight about the recent change in policy to bring U.S. troop levels down, what would you say to him?
I would tell him that I think it's extremely misguided. I think that it misunderstands what we most need, and it will squander the opportunity that we now have to win this fight.
Fred Kagan, what's your sense of within the military? Does the Pentagon share your view? Are they going quietly along with a politically oriented strategy?
I think that there's a lot of confusion, and I think that you talk to soldiers on the ground and you get one perspective. You talk to their commanders, you get a very different perspective. And, of course, the military, the response you're going to get from the military is what they think is acceptable politically. It's very difficult to get military officers to think outside of the political box. So they're being told they can't have any more troops, and you ask them, do you need more troops, and they say no.
And the box is built. Fred Kagan, it's been great having you tonight. Thank you so much for coming on. Hope we talk with you again.
Me too. Thank you.
Fred Kagan, military historian, author of While America Sleeps, and Lawrence Korb, terrific as always to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Nice to be with you again, Tom.
Lawrence Korb joined us from Charleston, South Carolina. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and senior advisor at the Center for Defense Information. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org in a moment. An excerpt from President Bush's major speech in London earlier today. This is On Point. Welcomed to Britain with royal pageantry, heavy security, and anti-war protests, President Bush today defended the war in Iraq, saying military might is sometimes necessary, must be applied to confront terrorism. Quote, in some cases, the measured use of force is all that protects us from a chaotic world ruled by force, Bush told a crowd at Whitehall Palace in London. Here is more from President Bush's speech earlier today.
The last president to stay at Buckingham Palace was an idealist without question. At a dinner hosted by King George V in 1918, Woodrow Wilson made a pledge. With typical American understatement, he vowed that right and justice would become the predominant and controlling force in the world. President Wilson had come to Europe with his 14 points for peace. Many complimented him on this vision, yet some were dubious. Take, for example, the Prime Minister of France. He complained that God himself had only 10 commandments. Sounds familiar. At Wilson's high point of idealism, however, Europe was one short generation from Munich and Auschwitz and the Blitz. Looking back, we see the reasons why. The League of Nations, lacking both credibility and will, collapsed at the first challenge of the dictators. Free nations failed to recognize, much less confront, the aggressive evil in plain sight. And so dictators went about their business, feeding resentments and anti-Semitism, bringing death to innocent people in this city and across the world, and filling the last century with violence and genocide. Through World War and Cold War, we learned that idealism, if it is to do any good in this world, requires common purpose and national strength, moral courage, and patience in difficult tasks. And now our generation has need of these qualities. On September the 11th, 2001, terrorists left their mark of murder on my country and took the lives of 67 British citizens. With the passing of months and years, it is the natural human desire to resume a quiet life and to put that day behind us as if waking from a dark dream. The hope that danger has passed is comforting, is understanding, and it is false. The attacks that followed on Bali, Jakarta, Casablanca, Bombay, Mombasa, Najaf, Jerusalem, Riyadh, Baghdad, and Istanbul were not dreams. They're part of a global campaign by terrorist networks to intimidate and demoralize all who oppose them. These terrorists target the innocent, and they kill by the thousands. And they would, if they gain the weapons they seek, kill by the millions and not be finished. The greatest threat of our age is nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons in the hands of terrorists and the dictators who aid them.
President Bush speaking at Whitehall in London earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.